This is an oral history interview with H. Edwin Young. It is February 6, 2006, and Judy Craig is doing the interviewing. Now, I interrupted you. You were starting to talk about Arlen Christensen being the person who recognized the TAA and kept track of all of the times.
Well, he, I don't know what he kept track of, but he was the one. I wouldn't want to put this on the record. He did it without my approval.
Well, now, let me... Okay, I think...
I do want to say that, you know, I don't... My memory isn't very good, and I didn't keep very good records. And if there's some dispute, I'll be glad to...
Disavow it?
Well, no, I won't go that far, but I'll negotiate it.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, you were talking about Arlen Christensen.
Yes.
And so we're talking about the days in 1968. You became dean. No, you came back as chancellor in 1968. Yes. So if we are talking about Arlen, that would be...
But
at that time,
I think he recognized them before that. They were recognized. When were they first recognized?
Well, they started. Getting organized. Their first meeting was in 1966, and they were working at getting organized during 66, 67, 68. They had a meeting. And you met with them, and according to the records I have, you indicated that you weren't going to recognize them at that time. And Arlen, you had a very small group of people who were
working with me,
advising you,
yes.
And Arlen was one of them.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I somehow Arlen agreed to recognize them without discussing it with me. But since he was speaking for my agent, I thought it was inevitable sooner or later. I happen to believe in collective bargaining.
Yes,
That made me seem like a strange one to be doing it. Well, anyway.
Well, actually, I think there are a lot of people who think that that's why. That's one of the reasons that the TAA got started here, because you do have a background in collective bargaining and you do believe in it. That's not the case, huh?
I think it's because, well, it might have been, but I didn't have a chance to say
okay.
Yes or no.
Okay. Well,
see, some years later, when the proposal in the faculty for the faculty to have collective bargaining, the two principal speakers against it were Jack Barbash and me.
Oh, really?
Because you have to think about what it meant. See, the faculty had been running things. The faculty decides who you hire. Really, you don't hire anybody that the department doesn't want.
Mm-hmm.
You don't promote anybody that promotion through the salaries that by the department. They'd give all that up, you see.
Mm-hmm. Well, you took a lot of criticism in the case of the TAA.
Oh, yes.
For recognizing them,
I know.
For doing that without having very much faculty involvement.
Yes, and his name was.
Okay.
But you might want to ask Christian
Arlen. I talked to him back when I was doing research on this topic. I don't remember him admitting that that he was the one who really did it, but we mostly talked about what happened then after you. Can you explain why, for the tape here, why it was that it was necessary to have a structure agreement first, you had to bargain about the terms of the bargaining, is my understanding. What it was that you were going to talk about.
Well, I think this was Arlen's doing. Mm-hmm. He wasn't, he wasn't behind my back. I was off the campus, was doing something that I don't know what.
Well, you were just here, and you had a very busy year that the first year that you were here.
Yeah. Well, that's the other problem is my memory isn't good and isn't perfect. Certainly, it's very imperfect, and the details of it. I trust Ireland's memory better than my own, because he was involved, but. See, I was a TA for Sally Perlman.
Mm-hmm. In the economics department at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes.
Yes.
And we had a good relationship, and he wouldn't have liked to bargain with me.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like controversy anyway. He turned everything over to me when I was just a new TA. I hired the TAs. I hired David Johnson, who was my own.
Who hired me?
I did.
He did. No, David Johnson did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Dave, you ever see Dave?
Not.
My wife died. I bought one of the new apartments, paid them some money. And then my daughter was living in Georgia,
mm-hmm.
wanted to come back to Madison because of the schools for her children. She didn't have a very high opinion of the Georgia schools.
Mm-hmm.
So they came back and to live with me and take care of me, so I canceled. I took back most of my money, but I still have money at Oakwood.
Mm-hmm.
For a while I was on their foundation board, so I know Oakwood pretty well, and,
mm-hmm.
and I guess Judy Heidelberger was living there. She was a close friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
me and my wife, and she lived there before she went to the hospital the last time. Her husband was invented 5-FU.
Yes, in fact, as I told you, I was reviewing the Cronin Jenkins volume that covers this period of years that we're talking about, and it did mention the Heidelberger.
It mentions some problem with the federal government.
With the patents, and
patents, yes.
Yes, it did, and yeah. And maybe we can talk about that a little
bit.
Well,
I think Bill Young was the one who got that straightened out eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But when he got through, he had a low opinion of Charlie.
Oh, well, he certainly did come up with something that has been very important as a medical...
Well, while he was developing that, Charlie and I sometimes sailed together, and we were socially... we lived near each other at university houses.
Mm-hmm.
So. He talked to me about it, but I didn't know enough chemistry to understand what was going on.
Yeah. University houses were a wonderful blending device for faculty. So many faculty members became good friends and colleagues and trusted each other.
Mm-hmm.
In the time that we're talking about with the TA strike, those relationships were very important, I think.
D.B. Fred was the one who promoted University House. He got the foundation to build it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that junior faculty members live there as much as they did in your day. There are more housing alternatives for them, probably.
Yes.
A lot of international
yes.
postdocs and so on, researchers live there. But let's go back to you and the TAA, and so you were you'd been a teaching assistant yourself.
Yes.
Did that help in your discussions with the TAA, or did that?
It colored it more than helped, because I knew what it meant to me to have the personal relationship with the professor. a great deal. And I wanted that, I didn't want to get some organization. See, I knew enough about unions to know that when the statewide or the people in the top of the union that they were affiliated with wanted to do something different, it was likely to happen.
Yes.
And
So you were convinced that either Arlen Christensen had gone ahead and maybe let the horse out of the barn, or else it was inevitable in any case that you were going to be bargaining with the teaching assistants.
When I discovered that Arlen had done it, I went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
He was working, he did it in good faith. Arlen, I think he believed in it,
mm-hmm.
because the lawyers make a lot of money out of collective bargaining.
No, he
wouldn't do it for that reason, but you know, a lot of people, well-meaning people, thought if the janitors have it, why shouldn't the TAs?
Mm-hmm. And what would your answer be to that if we were not? If you were not having to defend the fact that we were in a bargaining relationship with the teaching assistants, why do you think that that isn't applicable to teaching assistants? I guess you started to say talk about your relationship with your major professor.
Yes. Well, why I didn't, I think the unions do a lot of things good, but one of the things they push for is uniformity. And that is not a very easy thing when you have faculty governance. If some of the faculty wouldn't want to be governed by the union if they could help it. But it hasn't turned out too badly, I guess. I don't know. I haven't done any checking.
Well, it doesn't exist at the UW-Madison at this point, although...
No, for the TAs it does.
It does, yes. Yeah, no, yes.
But Jack Barbash and I were the killed it at the...
Yes, for the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Although I see that a Republican leader, yes, in the legislature now has indicated that he supports a bill to make it possible, so enabling legislation,
yes,
for the faculty.
Well, that may come, but I hope not.
But there was no enabling legislation, no legislation that allowed for the teaching assistants to bargain with the university.
Not at that time.
So what did, what was the mechanism that you came up with?
Well, I can't, that Arlen came up with.
Okay.
Well, whatever, I recall exactly, but... Anyway, they did get some bargaining, and they get, I think, probably a pretty civilized way. They did get agreements, and there was a channel for the TAs who felt they had nothing to say to have something to say.
It was. I guess I would, if we weren't on tape and talking about your recollections of the times there, I would probably argue with you about how civilized it was and how good it was. I do think that it has done some good things,
mm-hmm.
but for a long time it didn't. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, actually, that I think that it's been better since we're not working with the structure agreement that Arlen and others at the time worked out. And one of the reasons is that the structure agreement that was the basis for the bargaining for 10 years allowed the TAs to bargain about educational issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that you all tried very hard to keep from from getting into the contract, but some of it was in there. Mm-hmm. And of course some of it still is. But when the university bargained, all right, here's my theory, and this is not supposed to be on your tape recording, but the university thought of its teaching assistants as junior colleagues, the way you thought that you were with Professor
did.
Perlman. Some did.
Others thought of them as students.
Yes, yes. And that's true. That's true. But the people who were on the bargaining team mm-hmm. during the years between 1970 and 1980, many of them thought that they should be nice to the teaching assistants, because after all, they were our junior colleagues. And we let them get into more issues than we were willing to have them take all the way to conclusion mm-hmm. by bargaining. And so there was a lot of acrimony mm-hmm. and a lot of unhappiness when the Chancellor Shane withdrew from that structure agreement in 1980. The result was that the TAA worked to get enabling legislation, and now the TAA bargains under the aegis of the state, and the state treats them just like any other union mm-hmm. and doesn't let them get into things that aren't legitimate terms of the bargaining relationship. So I think it's less acrimonious now
yes.
than it was.
Well, I was thinking something occurred to me that they had a picket line out on the west side of campus, and I used to go out there and walk along and talk to them. So they had a meeting, and everybody was instructed not to speak to me.
So, because you were being too friendly with them.
I was undermining them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't that I was giving them too much, but I was willing to discuss things with them.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't trying to pull any rank. There was a problem that I didn't really want, but there was no avoiding it, I guess, for the long run, because they could promise everything, and I couldn't promise only the things I could deliver.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference.
Why, and maybe you've just given the answer to that, but one of the things that was not bargained about in those days was wages.
Yes, well, the state wouldn't let us.
Okay, but you didn't ask the state if you could bargain with the teaching assistants in the first place.
No.
But did you ask them about did you talk with people at the state about this while it was while it was developing?
Not very much, because my position was much more I had not decided to recognize them at that time, and I think Alan jumped the gun a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know. It's hard to tell. You don't know what you do unless you're absolutely faced with it.
Mm-hmm. Was do you recall if John Weaver was at the system at the time, or at the presidency? It wasn't the system. At the presidency of the university at that time?
Well, I was trying to think when he...
I guess I have the answer to that. I think he wasn't there before 1970. He came in the spring of 1970,
mm-hmm.
Probably around the time that the strike was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what the you were in a really interesting situation at that time, because you had a president who, I guess it was Fred Harrington at mm-hmm. the beginning of mm-hmm. the time. Now, he was somebody that you could talk to about
yeah.
about the situation that was going on.
Yes.
And probably you were able to consult with him.
We were We were more in agreement than any disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
I think he agreed with me that the longer we put it off, the better.
Mm-hmm.
John Weaver, I couldn't talk to about it.
And the interesting part about that is that you were the head of the Madison,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't have much else to be head of in his role as president at that time, because the system wasn't really in existence yet.
So he tried to be head of things. He didn't try too hard. John liked the pomp of circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. He was a lazy man, really.
Well, there was, instead of pomp and circumstance, there was a lot of acrimony and dissent at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to, I guess in many ways, he was the public face of the university more than you were at that time.
Mm-hmm.
In reading accounts, he was newspaper accounts and so on. He was out there in the public and,
mm-hmm.
you know. Well, do you remember particular instances of faculty, UW-Madison faculty reactions to what you were into, whoever got you into it?
Yeah, well, I don't. There were some. They blamed me for their problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood why they did. And so Arlen was doing, it did what he thought was best and under the circumstances at the time. And he was working for me, and I felt I ought to back him up. I had a great deal of respect for Arlen as a person.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't choose to denounce the thing. Mm-hmm. I
came across something that indicated that Jack Barbash thought that the TAA was a revolutionary TAA, or revolutionary union, that it was not really trying to improve the worker lot. It was trying to reform the university.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's what was going on?
It was mixed up. See, that some people were using it as a tool for their other purposes. This is where we have gotten in trouble. Whenever there was anything national or international going on, the TAs were very active. But some of them, but not all, well, many weren't.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably was true.
Yeah. And I also saw that some of the faculty members, particularly in the foreign languages,
mm-hmm.
they weren't your biggest supporters in this
no,
issue,
they
were they?
Weren't.
No,
they were. They wanted to keep the master-servant relationship.
Uh-huh. Well, some of them argued that that all of this was because the university overreacted to the Dow situation, mm-hmm. the spring before the strike. Do you think that that had much to do with it?
I don't think so. I don't think the people I knew, they didn't blame the TAs for the
bombing. No, I think what they were arguing was that if the university hadn't been so awful to the people who were rioting, who were protesting the war and so on, if the university had been more understanding to them and had treated them better, there wouldn't have been a teaching assistance. There wouldn't have been a need for a union.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear that argument?
I don't recall hearing it. I don't think it had very much to do with it.
Okay.
But
well,
it could have. Of all the groups that I think never understood what was going on, the people in the languages were. My son-in-law is a professor Romance Languages at Harvard.
Uh-huh.
And his understanding of the world was somewhat limited.
He could have fit into the languages here at that time?
No, he would have if he'd been here.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But there was one I suppose there were many, but there was one faculty member in the languages that was very helpful and very understanding. That was Bob Mulvihill.
Yes, yes.
I counted on him a great deal.
Mm-hmm. He was in Spanish and Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually was, his name goes with the report that studied the TA situation. Mm-hmm. And recommended many of the features that eventually got included in the contract, like long-term support guarantees and mm-hmm. so on. He was a good man.
He was. His interest with the university. He would put loyalty to the university above. But I found him very helpful. He had some people in his department who raised hell for him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they were about departmental matters.
Mm-hmm.
And but the understanding of the current political scene anywhere, I don't think that. With the few exceptions that the language people pay much attention.
Mm-hmm. What about, say, the mathematicians? They also had vivid reactions.
Mm-hmm. Different ones had different reactions, mm-hmm. That's right. And yes. Well, again, you know, what bothered me is how little they knew what they were talking about. They didn't know. It was easy to hear the TAs tell them the great advantage of them, but it wasn't the fact that faculty didn't understand what it meant, some mm-hmm. many of them.
What about your colleagues in the economics department? Now, you hadn't been in the economics department as a full-time faculty member for quite some time by then.
For instance, Jack Barbash and I would have the same view.
Mm-hmm.
The man, Jerry Summers.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And Bob Lampman. They understood what it mm-hmm. was about, and they probably would share my views pretty closely.
Mm-hmm.
We had a strong group in the department.
Yes. Yeah. Before we were on tape, we were talking a little bit about Jim Stern, who
yes.
was in the economics department, also in the Industrial Relations mm-hmm. Research Institute, mm-hmm. which was a graduate program,
mm-hmm.
And trained many people to mm-hmm. be labor organizers or to go out into the labor world. What about Jim? What about his role in all this?
It wasn't very large. I don't think, again, his attitude, I think Jim's would be, well, they've got it so good, well, why should they mess it up for the collective bargaining? See, Jim had worked for the auto workers. In fact, I can tell you how he got to be on the faculty, even.
Okay.
Elizabeth Brandeis was in the department, mm-hmm. and she came in one day and said, Ed, I heard a man named Stern talk, and we ought to have him in the department. And he's giving us talk up at little farther east.
Wausau?
Near Portage.
Okay.
And you ought to go up and listen to him. So I did. Didn't introduce. Got in, walked in the back of the room, sat down. And I was quite impressed with Jim. And I've not changed my mind about that. he was more, maybe a little more pro-union than I am, but he didn't go overboard.
Mm-hmm.
See, a lot of the people that got into the labor movement found that not only did you get your things, but there were some straitjackets too, some things you couldn't do. One time, Bob Ozan came, he was running the school for workers at the time, came into my office and said, I don't know whether I was I was probably the titular director. Mm-hmm. See, I've worn a lot of different hats.
Yes, I know you have, and I'd love to have you talk about them a little bit.
He said, there's a couple of people being fired by the unions, amalgamated union that would be good people for our faculty. One was Tibbetts, and what was the other fellow's name? Anyway, he was, we should try to hire them. And I said, well, go ahead, bring them out, let's talk to them. We did decide to hire them. 2 weeks later, a chap came into my office and said he was from the...
One side two of the interview with Ed Young on in February 2006. Okay, go ahead.
It said, you can't hire. I said, why can't we? Well, the union doesn't approve of them. They fired him for in subordination or something. And I said, well, it just happens that I don't work for that union. And we're going to keep them. And they became very popular with the labor people in the state. Tibbetts, the other one was.
Mm-hmm.
Tibbetts and...
Hiring faculty members was a little less by formula at that time. I mean, you had a lot more authority to do things on your own then.
Well, yes, but there was a committee, but their attitude was, if go ahead and do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
The more difficult part of it was when you try to bring somebody like Jack Barbash, because he wanted an academic position, but had to persuade the department.
Mm-hmm. And you brought Jack in. He was quite an impressive addition to the department. In fact, I see that you really turned the department around from... this is economics that we're talking about now, but I'm tempted to get off onto that a mm-hmm. little bit, but I think maybe we should go ahead and talk about the TA situation a little bit more, and then if we want to come back to mm-hmm. things like your coming in to chair the department, we can do that.
Which I know more about.
Oh, well, okay.
But anyway, yes, what more do we need to talk about the TAs?
Well, let me ask you, let me just look at my notes here. One of the things that was an issue early on in the bargaining was, as soon as the TAA was recognized and had that election, recognition election, or representation election, a lot of departments wanted to start settling things with the TAs in their departments. They wanted to have departmental bargaining. And you and probably the committee, you had formed by that time a committee of faculty who were doing more advising, didn't think that was a good idea. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I don't think it was a good idea because you couldn't have TAs and joining offices having different relationship with the university. That would be my reaction. Mm-hmm. I don't remember being very heavily involved. When did I go to Maine?
You had come back from Maine by that time.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking now about the period from beginning in 1968. Mm-hmm. And actually, we're talking about 1970 when we were involved in the bargaining for the first contract. Mm-hmm. And in 1970, you'd been back almost 2 years by that time, and you had had in your first year, you had a, in 1968-69, there was the black student strike in the spring after you came, and then the next fall, there was the TA and all of the fuss about that, and then there was the strike for the teaching assistants, and so it was while that was going on in probably your second year back from Maine.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what was the question?
Well, we were talking about the difference between departmental bargaining and bargaining at the campus level.
Now, see, to me that would have seemed an incredible way, a wrong way to do things, just automatically.
Letting, say, some of those foreign language departments set up their own terms?
They should, they would have to go through the bargaining committee.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, we would allow exceptions for only the some department needed, especially if they agreed with it, but we wouldn't turn them loose.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly language department.
Yes.
But that's what Mulva Hill was very useful.
Mm-hmm. You had a committee that had representatives from different parts of the campus, but most of them were from letters and science, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. And was the graduate school involved in?
Well, if you involve the letters and science faculty, you involve the graduate school.
Yes.
Same people, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You had, was Arlen, I'm trying to think of the people you had involved. Neil Bucklew became involved in the process soon. And I'm thinking he was really administering the bargaining relationship. Arlen Christensen was a faculty member, and he was teaching and doing the other things that a faculty member does.
He made the big decision and went off and left it, more or less.
Okay. But two names that come from around that time are Ed Krinsky and Neil Bucklew.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what their roles were?
I can't remember exactly what they did. They probably picked up and did. And if you have a contract, you have to keep following it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was running back and forth to Asia and.
Oh, okay. You were still doing that. You were not very much involved in the bargaining then. I believe that the teaching assistants tried to get you involved.
Mm-hmm.
The university was really breaking new ground because there were no other unions of this sort, mm-hmm. no graduate student unions anywhere in the country at that time. So this was something that was relying on your knowledge, you and your advisors' knowledge of labor unions, and you meshed it together with what the university was all about?
Yes, well, I think so. See, those of us who knew something were not as excited about this as a solution to the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no real problem, you see. Some TAs wanted to have more authority. One of the demands was they choose the textbooks.
Oh. Okay. That probably was not very well received by the faculty.
No.
No. In some ways, didn't you need the TAA to come up with some outrageous proposals like that? I mean, if they had been, if they hadn't tried to get things that challenged the faculty authority, mm-hmm. it would have been harder for you to resist the things that they wanted to do.
Probably. But, see, they wanted to do what the faculty, make the faculty's decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, some of them did. What I was, Mr. Perlman's teaching assistant, I hired David Johnson without, and, you know, it wasn't a bad choice.
Mm-hmm.
But, so I had in mind a different model.
But okay.
I'm sure it was quite different from the way the math department or the language departments treated the TAs.
Probably. Can you comment on after the strike ended, after there was a contract that had been approved by the university and the TAA, you had to get the regents and the legislature to approve this first contract. Can you comment at all on what that process was like?
No, and I don't remember it at all.
Okay.
But I guess I had enough ships, you know, I have good relationships with the regents and the legislature personally. Mm-hmm. So I think they went along, and particularly some of the leading people in law school thought it was desirable.
Mm-hmm. And Nate Feinsinger was involved in
yes.
at that time. Would he have been one of the people who got things approved by the regents?
He might have, but I don't think we had a problem.
Okay.
I think at that time the regents were saying, well, you do what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How was it when you, and this is quite a few years after that, when you were at the helm of the system, and it was a system by that time.
Mm-hmm.
It had many other universities as a part of the system,
mm-hmm.
and the system president dealt with other universities and not just Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how was that difficult to make that transition for you?
Well, to summarize it, I didn't enjoy being president of the system as much as I did being chancellor. And I enjoyed being dean more than chancellor.
I tend to think that being the dean of L&S is probably the best job on campus. But
yes. You can do many good things,
mm-hmm.
and you can stop some bad things.
And you have less opportunity for both of those things when you're at the system, do you think, or at that time?
Yes, well, the system, you can't have deans and presidents of the universities and tell them what to do and take responsibility. So as far as the collective bargaining was concerned, as I recall, that was turned over to each individual campus.
Mm.
There was more among the faculty on the individual campus, more interest in doing it than at Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Because they wanted some authority, and they were running from the top down, most of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that system, that situation is still the way it was when you were in the system, but the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee has a teaching and project assistant mm-hmm. Bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have had that when you were at system, I don't know, but it would have been delegated to the
yes.
to the university. Can you talk a little bit about how you came? You were at the University of Maine mm-hmm. as president from 1965 to 1968, mm-hmm. and you came back to Madison in the spring of 1968 while Bill Sewell was chancellor. He was chancellor in 1967-68. Mm-hmm. How is it that you came back to the system? You were a vice president, mm-hmm. And you fortuitously were here when the chancellorship at the Madison came open. How did that happen?
Well, I don't know all of it. I'll tell you what I know.
Okay.
When I was president of Maine, and there was some serious talk about having a system in Maine, and the legislators who were promoting it were telling them that everybody would get the same level of salary that they got at Orono. Maine didn't have that kind of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I argued against that. Then one day I got a phone call from Fred Harrington. He said, Ed Al, would you like to come back to Madison? And I said, do what? He said, be the inside run the campus from the university. You'd be the inside person. Well, I would be the outside person.
Uh-huh.
I said, well, I'll consider it. So I faced with the problems that the legislators were making for Maine for the future. I didn't want to be the person to have to cut Orono in order to build up some small place.
Mm-hmm.
So I, although it's worked out better than I thought it would, but it's not Madison. Anyway, so I came back. And I found an office waiting for me, I guess. And I
was that in Van Nuys?
In Van Nuys.
Okay.
And I went in to see Fred, and I said, Fred, have you told Bob Clodius that I'm in charge around here?
He said, Clodius was vice president then, mm-hmm. also.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He was the. He'd been the principal vice president, but I don't know why Fred didn't promote him more. But anyway, he said, "Well, he'll find it out, won't he?" That was
oh,
a hell.
That's
of,
reassuring.
I was a hell of a spot yeah. for me to be in.
Yes. Yeah.
And so. I tried to play down my authority role because I didn't really want that. And I got relieved when somebody, maybe it was Fred, remembered that I had been nominated for chancellor when the first, before and hadn't taken it or something happened. So I'd cleared the committee. I'd been on the list the last time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he acted a little bit like our president of the United States is acting now. I don't need any clearance. We got it from way back.
Uh-huh.
So he called in the. He visited with the university committee, and they agreed that I would be a good chancellor, or but they would approve that, and the regents went mm-hmm. along. That's it. But it was a very, and then I, of course, then Clodius was halfway my boss because he was vice
uh-huh.
president. But Baum and I got along pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the world differently. I helped get established who got with the first chancellor, Bob Fleming.
Mm-hmm.
Also
with the. Labor background.
Yes.
Yes.
And a very good arbitrator. Bob is very ill now. He's got Alzheimer's. His wife died last year. He was one of the steady people around. Very good.
And he was probably at Michigan during the time that...
He was at Illinois, and then he came here, and then he went to Michigan.
Right, mm-hmm. right. When you were when you were the chancellor mm-hmm. in Madison.
Yeah, he was, mm-hmm. I succeeded him as chancellor.
Right, yeah.
But...
Well, now, you don't suppose that Fred Harrington brought you back because he could see the way things were going with Chancellor Sewell, because he tried to resign several times, according to things that I've read during the year, and Harrington persuaded him to stay.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't suppose that he just was bringing you to have you there?
I never supposed that. I thought he really wanted me to relieve him of a lot of things he was doing. And he and I would got along well. We mm-hmm. weren't pals and sorts, but we traveled together in Asia and places and done things. And I never knew what was in his mind. It seemed like a strange way to do it, but
mm-hmm. well, it worked.
Things moved faster.
Yes, yes.
And then I was chancellor without much scrutiny.
Mm. Well, but you had had a lot of scrutiny in the past. But
yeah.
So you were chancellor and for almost 10 years, mm-hmm. I guess, and then you went to be the system mm-hmm. president. But you didn't enjoy that as much, you said.
No,
that was still early days of the system, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, but nobody's ever asked me what could bother me most. The thing that bothered me most was some problems in the regions. We had a couple of regents who were trying to do what Pat Lucy wanted done.
Uh-huh.
For instance, one of the person who wrote the merger bill was at that time a professor at Wayne, I think.
Oh, David Adamany.
Yes. And they were determined that there was a vice presidency open, and they were determined to bring Adamany. And we submitted his name to the faculty twice, and it was turned down because Adamany made that speech they don't do research, it's killing time.
Mm-hmm. Now, Adamany was a product of the university. He had a PhD in political science.
And a fine person. And if the faculty had approved him, I'd gladly mm-hmm. would have brought him. But see, I was fighting for faculty rights. If I told the regents, if you have a committee and you ask for advice and you don't, and then you turn it, don't take it, mm-hmm. so how many people are going to serve on committees?
Mm-hmm.
No, I admired Adamany, and he did a great job at Wayne as president mm-hmm. there.
He was there a long time.
Yes. He mm-hmm. had to deal with the very tough unions,
yes.
the auto workers. They had the legislature and other things under their control. So Adamany, the person, I don't know where he is now.
He's at Temple. He's the president of, or the top officer at Temple University.
Mm-hmm. Well, he deserves it. See, I have a high opinion. That I was caught in this jam mm-hmm. between the faculty. We had a committee system. If they said no on two different occasions, maybe they were narrow-minded when they said no. But and then the people, two people on the regents who supported him were doing it. Because they were close friends of Pat Lucy's,
mm-hmm.
and I got a little tired of their coming in with brilliant ideas. That
mm-hmm.
they were, for instance, one of the things that they we had a committee to to establish goals for affirmative action. And they wanted to pass that. So I said, that'll be impossible. He said, well, don't worry about that. They'll keep the faculty on their toes. They were not really, they were quite out of, the best readers I had were older and more experienced, and the two best together were, on the same time were, I think Jake Fried Regent? No.
I don't know.
No,
about that.
Bert McNamara.
Uh-huh.
Was there.
Now.
See that picture over my head? Over here?
Not there. Yeah. Not there.
Still life?
Oh, yes, yes.
If you went to his house, in the dining room, all around the wall are those.
Uh-huh. That's what he's doing now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was in labor.
He was in steel work.
So he was the labor person on the Regents. They have kind
one,
of seats.
He didn't act for labor. Mm-hmm. He acted for the university. I had one wonderful Regents who put the university their primary concern. Yeah. And the two, Odie Fish,
yes,
was national chairman of the Republican Committee. And he and Bert McNamara were two of the best regents we had.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, the faculty, the Madison faculty, many of them still haven't gotten over the fact that we're part of a system. But back in those years, the reaction must have still been very, very strong of the Madison faculty against being part of a system.
Well, they didn't do much about it. They might talk against it.
Okay. So it didn't make, you didn't have problems much from that?
No. Well, some of the problems came from those campuses. Some of them were arguing with some of their chancellors that they weren't getting their fair share of the money, mm-hmm, and so on. Mm-hmm. Well, I had, as my vice president at that time, Reuben Lorenz.
Yes.
And there never was a fairer, more honest man in the world. And so they could never find anything where all right. and it was all there, but,
uh-huh,
but he, so I was very fortunate with Reuben to, if he said this is their share, I said this, that's their share.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew he'd done his homework. He was trained by a man named Cafferty.
Neil Cafferty.
He was a great one.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. We had some wonderful people around here.
Was Don Smith involved at the time that you were there?
Yes, Don Smith. I brought Don Smith in the vacancy that I guess that Adam and he didn't get.
Ah, okay.
I got Don Smith in a backhanded way. He was at the University of Minnesota.
Yes.
And he went to Indonesia to work on a big project we had over there. And he did such a good job that I wanted him to be a candidate. And he turned out to be a wonderful guy. He did the work and I took the credit. You can't get a better deal.
That's a very good situation.
Yes. Yeah. You know, Don loved to sit at the typewriter and write out long descriptions. He was quite extensive talker. Something come up which he knew something about, and he would say to the regents, now let me explain this to you. And they would say, oh my God, again. But they liked him,
mm-hmm,
even though it was a little, he explained it more fully than they really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, his widow is here,
yes,
Eileen.
Yes, Eileen, Eileen, yes. Mm-hmm. She and I were on, have been on some activities together. I don't know. They're things that don't relate to the kind of discussion that we're having, but she's a good, pleasant person to work with.
Yes, and she seems to have done well at her difficult job of dividing up his money.
Hmm. Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Are there other things or people in the system that you... You said nobody had asked you what bothered you most before. So are there other things that you wish people would ask you about your days at the system?
No, I think I just got tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
See, I've been an administrator for so many years.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I would recollect it, you were dean of letters and science here from 1961 to 1965. Actually, you'd been chairman. Do you count that being an administrator? Chairing the economics department? Okay.
That's what I did in the economics department is why I became president.
Okay. All right. You chaired econ from 1952 to 1961,
mm-hmm.
dean 61 to 65, president of Maine 65 to 68, chancellor 68 to 77, and then system president 77 to 80. So I guess you were entitled to think you wanted to get out of it.
It's better for an organization if they aren't waiting around for somebody to retire and have a chance to replace them.
Well, you had a wonderful opportunity to see things from the same thing from different perspectives, and that must have been fascinating too.
Well, I guess so. I tried not to make Maine a little Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
I tried not to make Wisconsin Harvard, which I, by the way, I, one of my jobs, I was on the Harvard Visiting Committee during this period, so I knew I would.
Okay.
And my son-in-law is a professor there, so I know something about Harvard, and I admire it very much, but
it's not Wisconsin.
No, we're not, and we're not at, I think Wisconsin gives more opportunities to people who haven't shown how good they are yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that probably...
People like Charlie Eidelberger, for instance, and a lot of the scientists particularly.
Do you, you were...
joined the chorus of people.
I'm going to stop you a second and say that this is tape two, side one of the interview, February 6, 2006, with Ed Young, your son-in-law.
Joined in the chorus of, against the new president.
Ah, yes. Who said some things about the hiring and support of women. Was that the issue that...
I think so. That was the issue. And it wasn't a wise thing to say, but it may have probably true.
Well, that was at the National Bureau of Economic Research, wasn't it, that comment was made?
I don't know.
I believe that it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the president made some remarks. He said, in afterwards, it was said in a kind of brainstorming session, and that got taken and used in ways that he hadn't intended. And I have to say that I was at an NBER conference about 3 years ago, but was about collective bargaining for graduate students and or graduate assistants. And the dean, graduate dean from Illinois, and I were the only two who were from the maybe university perspective of these issues. And we were sandbagged by there were graduate student union, they were having a fuss at the time about whether NYU and other private universities could bargain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we got into some discussions that you are brainstorming and thinking about possibilities and not expecting that what you're saying is going to be taken out in the in the rest of the world. So I have felt some sympathy for the man, even though it was a women's issue that I should have been less.
But there was some other issue. There's another issue, the black issue.
Okay. Oh, okay.
he invited one of the leading black professors in to tell him about his research.
Yes.
And
Gates, I think.
What?
Gates, the...
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the president didn't think so much of that, told him so.
And yes.
He united the black professors around the country against him.
Right. Right.
I don't know him personally, but I know his work, and he's a good, solid economist.
Mm-hmm.
And not as discreet as it might be. But
well,
anyway,
that raises the issue of women's rights and so on, and those are things that were going on. That movement is something that was going on while you were chancellor.
Yes.
Title IX was passed, I mm-hmm. think, while you were in office.
Mm-hmm.
Can you have anything to say about what happened and what
well,
was going
I,
on?
I well applauded it.
Mm-hmm.
My training in women's roles in the universities was by Elizabeth Brandeis.
Uh-huh. She was quite a woman.
She was. And she and sort of took me under her wing, and me and my wife, and we went to their house frequently. And for instance, I told you, she was the one who moved
who Jim got Stern. You interested in Jim Stern's hiring,
mm-hmm.
yes.
And so I've been always in the woman's camp. I don't go out and make speeches about it, because they make their own better than I can. I had a mother who was very strong and able.
I think that I recall that you appointed a committee. The first efforts under Title IX were in sports,
mm-hmm.
in athletics, and you appointed a committee to make some recommendations
mm-hmm.
about what
so.
We should do. Kit Saunders, do you remember Kit Saunders?
Yes.
She was the first, you appointed her, I think, as director of women's athletics?
Maybe, I don't recall.
Okay.
It's a tough situation there at every major university because it's a division of the money.
Mm-hmm.
And why waste money on women because they don't get an audience?
They do pretty well at
sure
getting is. Audiences here. It's been a...
Yes. They've been pretty well treated here. And I believe in that. I pushed for it.
Serena Pondrum's appointment part of the that general area of effort?
Yes. She was I was looking for somebody, and I think it was Dave Johnson who recommended her, and I appointed her to Affirmative Action.
Was she in the was she a faculty member at the university?
Mm-hmm.
In the English department at that time? Uh-huh.
Her husband was in the English department.
He was in the physics department.
Yes, physics.
Yeah.
Enough, somebody else.
And they're both still there, so.
And she wins awards. She's a list of things. She and Irv didn't get along too well. Irv Shane.
Mm-hmm.
They were both bright people and
both strong personalities.
Mm-hmm.
So she was a. Was she a vice chancellor? Irv was the.
She was never a vice chancellor. I've forgotten her title, but she worked on the affirmative action issues.
Mm-hmm. And pay. Well, that was a. She did equity, pay. Studies and so on. I think.
I don't recall that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you wanted to talk a little bit about the days when you were, when you moved from being in the School for Workers to, or directing the School for Workers to chairing the economics department.
Well, I didn't move. I kept on doing both.
Okay, all right. That's the Wisconsin way, I think.
Yes,
you just take on more.
Coming to the department, that was an interesting thing. I was the most junior tenured faculty member when I became chairman. The man who made me chairman was Walter Morton.
Oh.
Because he raised so much hell
that
people, he drove Mr. Witte out of the chair because he couldn't stand it. He was a very distinguished person.
Both of them,
yes.
Actually.
Both
Witte and Morton were distinguished.
Yeah, but Witte was much
okay,
more.
Okay.
Much more. Witte wrote the Security Law.
Yes, right.
I mean, and other things. And I think Morton was what, psychological, and when you think everybody's against you.
Yes, paranoid.
Paranoid. He was paranoid. And so, for some reason or other, the department thought I would, junior member, could handle it, or maybe they thought they should sacrifice me to the fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that you came to the department as a teaching assistant.
The first time.
Okay, and then you came back as an assistant professor in 1947.
Mm-hmm. With the promise that, that's maybe interested in how I came back.
Okay.
I got a letter from Professor Witte, who was the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that we're looking for somebody to carry on the labor history. And the top man in the country turned us down. That was Taft at Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And we got his PhD here working with Perlman in the four-volume history. And he said, we talked it over and we decided we'd better we get somebody and train them. And if you're interested in this, I'd been here before for a year as a graduate student. Would you go to the American Economic Association meeting in Atlantic City in February and meet me there and we'll talk about it?
Okay.
And I did that and we talked about it. So I came back with the understanding that I could finish my degree. See, I didn't have a PhD. And when I got finished, I'd be a full member of the department as an assistant professor and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got back. In the, you know, the chances of things like that happening are very rare.
Yes.
And that happened to me. And I came back, and Walter Morton was carrying on. He had a great ability at denouncing people, ridiculing people. He made a lot of money at that, working for public utility corporations against the regulators. Oh. He could make fun of them and ridicule them. He did that to some of his colleagues. But he, when any new person was appointed, he immediately explained to them what was wrong with everybody else and why they were against him and so on. Well, the issue that set things off was that, I don't know how they do it now, but the faculty recommends the pay increases.
Mm-hmm.
And he was making a big fuss because why give an increase to Elizabeth Brandeis? She doesn't need it. Her father left her a lot of money, and her husband's got a job working for the state. And he was carrying on that vein, Mr. Whitty was chairman, but he was killing Mr. Whitty, trying to manage with this guy, raising hell with him. So they made me chairman.
I heard that Mark Ingram had to chair some meetings for a while, because everybody was so split, and
So I stood so much in Morton, and I said, Walter, if you don't behave like a normal citizen, don't come to the faculty meetings. I threw him out. I didn't have a lot to lose.
Well, you had tenure by that time, at least.
Yeah, and let's see, did I?
You got your PhD in 1950, mm-hmm. and you became chairman of the department in 1952, which is a pretty short period of time.
It's too short.
Yes, yeah.
Anyway, so the result was that Morton went up to the president's office and complained about that I was mistreating him and so on. So president at that time, the old man Fred.
Oh, yes.
Ruby Fred. It was always he liked peace and quiet. And this wasn't peace. So he decided to settle it. So he invited all the departments members to come up and meet with him. Mm-hmm. Morton's indictment to me was read or discussed, presented. And then Paul Ellsworth got up and said, let's be sensible. Ed is doing his best he can, and we'd better back him. We'll give him unanimous support. I move. That
turned the tide and...
Yes.
Yeah.
Gave me some authority. And then I think that's what made me dean, because Morton was notorious over the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult. Somebody who could get a handle on him. And it was sad. He had a very nice wife, and he raised hell. Her life was hell. His son is living in Madison, has some kind of business, and his father's money. Walter made a lot of money working for public utilities. The son gives a lot of it to the university.
Mm. Well, there's a conference room in the economics department that's called the Walter Morton mm-hmm. Conference Room. Mm. And I knew that was a gift,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't quite understand this background. That it's interesting that the department named a conference room after him.
Maybe they felt that we'd done wrong by kicking him out.
Well, he stayed around, and I remember him coming in every now and then, and he was still a little bit off-putting, but not like this description. So
we got on with department business anyway.
Yeah. You liked being department chair.
Was he interesting? It was something different.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of, was able to, and I believed in the system of the senior faculty discussing things and coming to some conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
See, that would have gone out the window with the union.
Yes, yeah. You did a lot of hiring while you were department chair.
I raised quite a lot of money. Brought to, we had nobody was doing mathematical economics, and Pete Steiner suggested that I go to Harvard and see if it could interest Orchid from leaving Harvard and coming there. I went to Harvard. I knew the chairman at Harvard. He says, Ed, you're just wasting your time. Nobody's going to leave Harvard to go to Wisconsin. But I had inside information that Orchid felt he'd been mistreated in the previous. He didn't get promoted as quick as he thought he should.
Oh. But egos are wonderful, aren't they?
Yeah. And but he wanted $100,000 to start with for what he wanted to do. It was in the back of his mind a model of the U.S. economy, and wanted to do it right. He wanted to hire some people, and so I went to graduate school and asked for $100,000.
That was a very large
sum. Yes, and E.B. Fred, they went to E.B. Fred and told him that I wanted this kind of money. And E.B. Fred talked to somebody, I've forgotten who, that Ed Young wants all this money. What should we do? Well, give it to him.
Right.
I can't remember who we sought advice from, but E.B. Fred was kind of tight with money, His salary at the end was $12,000 a year, but he kept the house down by the lake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful house.
Mm-hmm. I used to go down there and see him. My wife and I were fond of both of the Freds. We'd go there frequently. And I a dozen times I remember him taking me out to show me his tomatoes and then showing me the brickwork up there and the quality of it. I like the old boy. One time he was in the hospital and I went to, that was the old building, old hospital. And we were talking. He said, "You can't guess what I did last night?" And I said, "Of course." "What did you do last night?" He said, "See that wheat basket over there?" He says, "A mouse came in and I got that waste basket and put it on top of him and sat on it till somebody came and took him away." And he said, "That reminded me when I was a young man growing up in Virginia, I think it was. They had a barn raising, and when they had a barn raising, they had a dance. And during the dance, this lady grabbed her leg, and she said, 'I've got a mouse.' And there was a stream of water running down too." He was telling me this, and he didn't hear very well, so he spoke quite loudly. And outside, the nurses were laughing.
Yeah.
We've had some real characters around this place.
Yes, we have.
I'm
we have.
Straight.
Let's see if I made any notes on some that I wanted to ask you about. Do you want to? Do you have any comment on Bob Doremus?
Yes, I like Bob very much. I inherited him. He was meticulous. He kept. He would like to say no sometimes, but he was a very hard worker, and a very bright person. I think he had a PhD in physics from Harvard or something like that.
Well, he was an English professor,
But he had.
He was a meteorologist. He became a meteorologist in World War II.
That was probably it. And I know he had some science.
He was fascinated by it, and
yeah, I liked him very much, but a lot of the faculty thought he was kind of bumbling, but he wasn't bumbling. He knew them inside out.
He trained me.
What?
He trained me.
Did he?
I worked with him in South Hall, and I have quite an imprint of him.
Did you work there when the elderly ladies worked down for the dean down on the, before I was dean?
Which?
Freidenberg, Ergen, somebody. Or, no. Well, they lived together.
No. What about Reed Bryson?
Oh, I've had a personal cordial relations. He sends me his poetry every Christmas. He writes a poem. Mm-hmm. But I like Reed. I never thought he should be running a university, but he never tried to, as far as I know. I just kind of liked him. He was egotistical, I think.
He built quite an empire in the
meteorology
area.
Mm-hmm, he did. Yeah. And you see, there were a lot of empires around this university built by people who knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Look at biochemistry.
Yes. And I'm blocking on his name. But he's still very active.
Yes, he was the last.
DeLuca.
DeLuca, he was the last student of what was the great man before him.
Steinbach?
No.
No?
Steinbach, yes. Steinbach's last student. Mm-hmm. And the reason I know this is that when we came, before we came to Madison the first time, we negotiated by mail to get a place to live. It was 45. And we shipped our furniture and everything to this point. When we got there, we went to see the landlord, and he said, "Well, he's sorry you had to tell me something I wouldn't like." He said, "We play bridge twice a week with a couple, another couple, and they live on the east side, and it's quite a problem for them to come over here. It would be much better if they were, we let them have the apartment."
So they could play bridge.
Yes.
All right.
So we were out in the cold. The housing people helped us find a summer place on the east side of the lake, and which was not winterized. When winter coming on, we moved to Badger. At a year at Badger Village, where we met got acquainted with a lot of people. I was telling you why I knew about the biochemistry department.
Oh yes,
Steinbach. The we rented a place. I get one year, for maybe our first year, not our second one. A little house there's a grocery store on the west side. They have good meat and things. The people go to it.
Kanakis.
Well, it was just up that road from Kanakis. We lived there, and So I, down the street a little farther was a MD from Minnesota who was getting a PhD with Steamboat. And so I used to ride into school with him and go, so I'd wait for him at the department, so I picked up a lot of the gossip. And the gossip amongst the graduate students was that Steamboat was over the hill and that, what's the current one?
Hector DeLuca?
Hector DeLuca was kind of second rate.
Oh, well.
Hector was the last student in Steamboat. Mm-hmm. He managed to survive it.
I guess. I hear of people who are looking for the Nobel Prize designation for him, but that...
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. See, I don't know enough about the science to know. He certainly is a successful administrator and politician.
Yeah, well...
I worked with him and liked him very much, but it wasn't because of his science.
I was looking, you, while you were dean, there was a lot of growth going on at the university.
The people coming back from the war, and the classes were getting larger.
Yeah, and the faculty size was increasing, but it was also getting we were getting more subject areas and more fields that were coming into existence. And I see that you were dean when urban and regional planning was created as a department, and African languages and literature and computer sciences.
You want to turn off the machine for a moment, and I'll tell you about it.
Okay. Urban and regional planning and African languages and literature and computer sciences. Do you have any?
Van Sina came. He was a great one.
He came to the history department,
History, but for African. He was African historian. And what was the other? Computing.
Computer sciences, yes.
And we got this chap there from somewhere where Mark Ingram spotted him and told me he was good. Who came for that. I think he was the one who was head of the master's.
John Noel?
No.
No. Barclay Rosser.
Barclay Rosser. He was the head of the computing and also the math research center. And what a terrible job he had there. The damn cardinal lied day in and day out about the research was going on there. There wasn't any. I had a firm understanding with every faculty member who was offered an opportunity to do research with government money that they had to clear it with me. Mm-hmm. I turned down quite a bit of it. Didn't want to defend it. But the mass research center was kept spotlessly clean. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that some of the professors on their own didn't go off and talk. They didn't report to me if they went on their own time and vacations and did things. But I went to conferences and met people. I don't know how much that went on. But, of course, they were working on problems that the military used. Mm-hmm. So that's why the military financed the whole math research center.
Now, you were chancellor at the time of the Sterling Hall bombing.
Yes.
Which was, of course, aimed at the Math Research Center.
Yes.
Do you have any thing that you want to say about that?
I probably shouldn't say it, but I think it was promoted by the Cardinal. Mm-hmm. They wrote so many stories about the researcher, that's why it was picked on. And the man who wrote those stories is now the chief editorial writer for the Milwaukee Journal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, people move into different
things and
different activities. So
some, you know, I can imagine a lot of people would never have predicted that I would be sitting here telling you about so many things.
Right, right. What about if more of or side two of tape two, and continuing the interview with Ed Young on February 6, 2006. We're just.
I like most people, and you see, if I were a genius, I would have higher standards. But I'm not a genius, so I respect other people for what they do, and they, I think they understand that. And this is why my colleagues would put me the most junior person in the department in the chair. They thought I would probably do the right thing.
Now, you don't. Do you think that your professional training, your labor relations background, helped you with that kind of thing?
Oh, I see. I didn't study collective bargaining. I did some of it. And I arbitrated. And the arbitration, I learned quite a bit from arbitration. But generally, people like to get credit for what they do, and I tried to give them big credit without being flattering people undeservedly, and that helps. And I never pretended to know how to do that, what they were doing better than they did. That's a serious mistake.
You spent a lot of time overseas when you were.
Yes, I have.
Still, when you were chancellor, were you doing some of the?
In fact, when I was at Maine, I was managing a project here overseas. Project.
And I saw that you were in Pakistan when you were named dean of LNS.
Yes. I was part of the Harvard group. Advising the government on economic policy. We enjoyed our time there. My wife wanted to go back, but the place is going to hell.
Oh, yeah. So the two places that you were mainly were Pakistan and Indonesia? Would that be?
Well, I did some things in the Philippines. I had one group in the Philippines. It was really a kind of a branch of the Indonesian activity. I spent some time teaching in Kuala Lumpur.
Were you involved in the Musea project?
Not only indirectly.
I'm just remembering that in my early years in the economics department, that was an active project.
I think they supported me on one of my overseas activities. I've forgotten what it was. I was thinking about my family and my children. That's the best thing we ever did for them, was to get them overseas and so they could discover that being different doesn't mean being less. See, we lived in Pakistan.
Were you teaching at universities there, or what kind of activities were you doing?
They had a national planning group, which Harvard had the contract to supply the people. And Harvard asked me to go over and help with the planning and dealing with the economists often trained in this country. We enjoyed ourselves very much and became very fond of some of them, and made good friends amongst the Pakistanis too. I don't know who. I think one of our former students promoted me to go to Kuala Lumpur. Suggested me to the government. the Indonesian thing came about in this fashion. One day I got a call from a professor at Yale, whom I knew because of our meetings with Lloyd Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, how would Wisconsin like to have a project in Indonesia, Ford financed and all these, chance to do all these things? And I said, Lloyd, if it's such a great opportunity, why doesn't Yale do it? He said, Ed, I'll tell you, our president believes that the world ends at the English Channel.
Huh. Okay.
He said he'd like to. Well, I set that up and got quite a lot of people involved. Have you met Mary Woodward anywhere?
Yes, I have. She was working with Lloyd McGowan, Wayne McGowan.
Mm-hmm.
And I met her when she was working with him.
Yeah. Well, she lives just down the street on the other side of Midvale.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, after a year of experience over there, where we helped select students to come to the United States for graduate work, and we brought them here and so on. And after a while, Lisa Darko took charge of them. She was a great woman. Oh, I liked her very much. She knew the difference between what was significant and what wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't bother me with trivial things. She made the decisions. Nothing was trivial.
Can you talk a little bit about the Center for Development? You had long involvement in that.
Yes, I ran that too. See, I ran several of these things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. When I had a good person doing the work, I took the credit.
Now, Mary Woodward was not involved
no,
in that.
No.
Well,
wait a minute. Let me tell you.
Okay.
I decided after visiting the project in Indonesia and seeing what was going on, or some experience bringing students that would be useful if there were, over there, a professor was way up there. Nobody, you don't approach them really very much. So there wasn't very much exchange between the professors and the students. Well, I thought that what the students ought to know what they were going to get into when they got here. And so I had the idea we'd send one of our own graduate students over. So I asked the department who I should ask to go. And one of the names was George Betts, and I don't know what the other one was. Anyway, George, the other fellow maybe dropped out. Anyway, George was a very good student. I think he'd have been a Rhodes Scholar or pretty close to it. So I sent him to Cornell to learn Indonesian. It was the only place in the country where they're teaching Indonesian at the time. And I got a phone call from him. Said he had a personal matter to talk to me about. I said, what's that, George? I said, once you're dean, if anybody says I got a personal matter, you wish they'd go away. But don't tell me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, I was talking with my girlfriend, Mary, who was an editor at Time magazine in New York, about my plan to go to Indonesia for a couple of years. And she said, if I go there, go off for 2 years, forget about her. He said, well, I said, well, what do you want to do? He said, I want to marry her and take her over there. But I said, well, what do I have to do with it? He said, under my contract with you, you pay for one person, but married people, you pay for both. I said, George, call her up and propose. He did. And they went over there, and she was the more successful one than he was, because she prepared the wives of these graduate students for something they could bring them. I worked that out with Ford. And got them to told them about the, what we expected, what the university was about, what, mm-hmm. what they could do in the community. Let's see. Now, I had this happen to me in another case. In the music school, there was a distinguished French horn player who'd been at one of the big Philadelphia orchestra before he came here, I guess. I've forgotten his name now.
I'm not going to be able to come up with that one.
Well, I got a call from him. He said he had a personal matter. He wanted to talk to me, but I said, come on up. He came up. And his matter was that he was, he and a woman member of the faculty of music were thinking of getting married, but there was a rule that when two members of the same family couldn't have tenure, mm-hmm. without permission of the dean or something like that. And he was a very proper man, almost pompous. So I said, you put me on the spot. He said, what, how was that? I said, well, if I don't approve of it, you'll be living in sin. And so I said, go ahead.
Well, those were probably pleasanter questions than, or issues, than many of the ones that came to you as dean. Mm-hmm. When somebody said, I have a personal problem, I'd like to talk
yes.
to you.
Yes, well, see, I was thinking of students. When uh-huh. students had personal problems, I had one thing when I was dean that nobody else, I think, ever had. I had a fund provided by, I think, the Rennebaum Foundation, I've forgotten, where I could, if a student needed some money badly, I could write him a check. I had a checkbook. Mm. Very extraordinary thing, and probably illegal all that. But anyway, students who were dropping out for a variety of reasons often used the financing as the excuse for dropping out. Mm-hmm. So I could write them a check to cover small amounts and kept them in school because they didn't have any other excuse in mind. And it was probably, and sometimes it was true, too. I know something about cost of education. I've got a number of graduate children uh-huh. in college.
Yes. You were going to tell me something about the Center for Development.
Oh, yes, for Development. How did we get that going?
Well, Bill Young was involved in
yes,
it.
Yes, Bill Young.
And I think you first had a group officials or bureaucrats from some country, but I'm not sure mm-hmm. yeah. what the early country
well,
was.
Well, the Indonesian group was in the to okay. get the money from Ford and supported it. Uh-huh. And we charged Ford administrative costs. Lucille Tarko worked for that.
Ah, yes.
And it seemed to be useful because we were able to help some of our own graduate students get jobs. And we had the program in Indonesia, in the Philippines, and I think that's about all, but...
Then it moved in later years to an emphasis on Asian, mm-hmm. Japan, and... I'm not sure.
Well, when I was associated with it, we had people like Dave Johnson and Marge in Singapore, and I went to spend some time teaching in Thailand, and so it it went where there was opportunities, and opportunities meant somebody was going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people going.
Yes.
Then.
Now,
quite a lot.
Probably the Land Tenure Center has a longer record of doing this kind of thing. And they had some very good people.
I'm just looking to see if there are particular things that I wanted to remember to ask you about. Mm-hmm. I have been asked to tell you that your furniture from the office that you had in Helen C. Whitehall, the teak furniture that you had, is very happy in South Hall now. Chris Brune, I don't know if you remember Chris, but he was the person who's doing space activities for LNS now. And the furniture and some of your old Badger yearbooks and other things like that are in his office. And
see, I left rather suddenly. I was ill.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I found a folder the other day that came home, and it was marked Ed Young Personal, which really meant personnel matters.
Uh-huh.
And
I'd
never read it.
Ah.
I'm wondering whether I should give it to the archives. Probably should.
Well, they'd probably be interested in
yes.
in taking a look
maybe
at it.
Let Dave Cronin look at it, see if there's anything useful in it. Well, let's see. This teak was put in that office by, I think, Bob Clodius.
Uh-huh. Okay.
He had it before I did.
I think that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do remember that.
Bob was more apt to spend money than I was.
Okay. Well, Chris says that it's very happy that the room that it's in South Hall is one of the few that has its original or at least long-time tin roof,
mm-hmm.
tin ceiling. And he's kept some of your records of I don't know, dating back a ways, like the Badger yearbooks. And mm-hmm. he said, anytime you're interested, just
I'll
let him know.
I'll take the furniture and let him keep the stuff.
Well, is that something that...
No, the furniture okay. isn't my furniture.
Okay.
That would be called corrupt.
All right. Well...
I moved out ill, and they moved my stuff out, and I got scattered pretty much. But it was being put to good use, that's fine, but I'm sure if it cost anything, I didn't buy it. With my money, the university's money.
Okay, well, it's being put to good use right
it's
now.
Good.
So, well, I think that's probably all that I have to ask you about right now. And if you think of anything else, you could give me a call, and I'll be glad to.
A piece of paper with your name and
okay.
telephone numbers.
I will do that, and I am going to call you.